Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. Our studio guest today is Ellie Griffiths. She's talking about her latest crime novel, The Stone Circle. We'll also hear from travel writer Tim Moore on why he chose to travel across Trump voting states in the US in a Ford Model T. And Carol Carmen talks about her novel, A Gingerbread Children. But first of all, welcome to Bookmark, Ellie.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Lovely to have you here. Now, of course, we'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. Of course, we're talking about books today. It's Bookmark. You worked in publishing before you became a writer.
Yes, I did. I worked at HarperCollins and I started off as a publicity assistant and I ended up being editorial director for children's books. And along the way, I worked on educational books like books for schools and then moved on to sort of children's fiction, which was huge fun because they published Tolkien and all sorts of other C.S. Lewis, all sorts of wonderful books.
But you've quoted as saying working in publishing completely put you off writing.
Yes, I don't want this to come out like I didn't like publishing because I really enjoyed it and I made loads of good friends there. But I think the thing is that publishing, and maybe this is just a really obvious thing to say, but publishing's quite commercial. I mean, it's all about money. If a publisher takes you on as an author, it's only so they can make money out of you. And I mean, that's not wrong because that's their job. They're venture capitalists, aren't they? But, you know, it's a commercial decision, not a literary one. So actually working in publishing is quite pressured and it's quite commercial. And it probably did make me forget that what I actually wanted to do was write books.
So when did you make that shift from working in publishing to writing?
Well, really, it was just because I got pregnant and I was on maternity leave. I've got twins who are now 20, so that would have been about 21 years ago. And I had a slightly longer maternity leave, maybe because I had twins. And I thought, oh, yeah, what I wanted to do was write a book. I mean, if you'd asked me any time, you know, when I was at school, I would have said I wanted to be a writer. I wrote my first book when I was 11, you know. I wrote Starsky and Hutch fan fiction, you know. I was writing all the time, but I had actually forgotten it in those few years working in publishing. So it was on maternity leave. I sat down and wrote what became my first published book.
And here we are. How many books later? 13?
I'm so mathematically challenged. I had to work this out on a bit of paper on the train coming here. But The Stone Circle is my 20th published
20th,
book.
20th? Really? Yeah. Wow. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
What those twins spawned when
I know. And they're 20. Oh, yeah. There's a little symmetry in there.
Well, we're going to listen to your first choice of music in just a moment. Is music important to you, Ellie?
It is. I don't listen to music when I'm working. I like complete silence. But music's very important to me otherwise, yeah.
Well, this is Every Day I Write the Book, Why This One, by Elvis Costello.
Well, I love Elvis Costello. I'm a big fan. But recently, last year, I went and did a little tour across America with two other writers, Amy Stewart and Mario Giordano. And we didn't know each other before. At all before we did the tour. And our first night, we sort of met in the hotel. And what could have been awkward was actually brilliant because we sat down and we wrote our playlist for the songs that we would have, you know. And of course, a lot of them were writer songs. And this was on all of our playlists. And it will just remind, I love this song, but it will just remind me of going across Florida with Amy and Mario singing along to this.
Every Day I Write the Book by Elvis Costello, fading away there. The first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest, Ellie Griffiths. Ellie's best-selling series of Dr. Ruth Galloway novels won the prestigious Crime Writers Association Dagger in the Library Award and has been shortlisted three times for the Theakston's All Peculiar Crime Novel of the Year. The Stone Circle is the 11th novel in the series. The Guardian said that Griffiths supplies proof that thrillers can increase the pulse rate while tackling more serious issues. And the Times said, Ellie Griffiths writes ever more ingenious detective stories with a powerful sense of place and a varied cast of sympathetic and unusual characters. Her heroine is a winner. Well, we'll come back to those quotes, Ellie, because they are bang on, I think. I've thoroughly enjoyed this book. But for people first who haven't read The Stone Circle, what's it about?
Well, as you were saying, it's about it's a Ruth Galloway novel, and Ruth is a forensic archaeologist. And in the very first book, in book one of the series, The Crossing Places, Ruth is consulted by the police when they find bones buried on marshland near her house. She lives on the North Norfolk coast. And the bones are buried near the remains of a wooden circle, the so-called Sea Henge. And this book, in a way, comes back to that setting because it starts with the detective with whom Ruth has a, let's say, complicated relationship, DCI Harry Nelson, receives a letter which reminds him of letters that were sent to him in that first book. And it tells him to go to the stone circle. And he thinks the circle is made of wood, but he asks Ruth, and she says that a second circle's been found and it has a stone kist in the middle, which is like a sort of gravestone, and under it are some bones. And so they go to the stone circle, and the new mystery starts from there, really.
I loved when I found out that it was going to be about a stone circle, because I love stone circles. There's something very evocative about it.
Yes, and in the course of this book, they also go to Stanton Drew in Somerset, and I was looking at all the legends about stone circles. So interesting. And Stanton Drew has one of those legends where it all started with a wedding party and on a Saturday, and then a mysterious fiddler appears all dressed in black, and he offers to play, and he plays these wild tunes, and they all dance, and they dance into the Sabbath, whereupon they're all turned to stone.
They're wonderful. They're quite elemental. And I suppose for you, it's a useful metaphor about uncovering the past.
Yes, yes, they are. And of course, there's a mystery as well. I mean, I think it's one of the ways in which archaeology goes well with crime novels, because it's often about, actually, it's often about a murder as well. Why are the bodies there? But also it's about mystery. We don't really know what these circles, we don't really know exactly what Stonehenge is for. You know, we know, you know, there are probably rituals of some kind, but there are many mysteries: how they got the stones there, how they are so beautifully seen from space when the people who made them couldn't have seen them from space. You know, there are just so many interesting mysteries.
And as you say, Ruth's a forensic archaeologist. When you were starting out the series, you obviously made a choice that she was going to be an archaeologist, not a detective, but it was going to be a crime series. Why did you make her an archaeologist?
Well, the reason really was that my husband's an archaeologist. In fact, he wasn't an archaeologist when I met him. He worked in a merchant bank in the city, but he'd always wanted to be an archaeologist and had sort of done law just because that seemed a more sensible thing to do at the time. But I always remember when I first met him, he said, "Oh, you know, I didn't want to work in a bank. I wanted to be an archaeologist." And I thought, "Oh, that's so sweet. Oh, bless him." So we got married. You know, maybe not immediately, but we got married, and then we had two children. And he said, "Oh, yeah, you remember that being an archaeologist? Well, you know, I'm going to do it now." So it seemed a lot less sweet, I can tell you. But really, it was wonderful for many reasons, and for him, but also for me, because it gave me the inspiration to write about Ruth. Through Andy, I found out there were such people as forensic archaeologists who are legitimately consulted by the police when they find buried bones or buried bodies, because they can tell how long they've been buried or how they were buried. So I thought that would be a very interesting contrast to have an academic and a detective. And their jobs are similar in some ways. You know, they're looking at the evidence. Archaeologists are very, very painstaking with the way they do that. But there would be differences. You know, Ruth is open to looking at the sort of mystical sides of archaeology, where the policeman, DCI Nelson, does not have any time for any of that sort of thing.
And as you say, it's a very complicated on-off relationship they have. He's a very strong character. Is there a tension for you when you're writing between two such strong characters? Because it's Ruth's book, but Harry is very charismatic, and he comes off every page.
Oh, I'm glad you think that. No, I quite enjoy that. I quite enjoy going between the two of them, and I always enjoy being both of them, really, you know, and there is some, you know, it is quite emotional at times. And also, I think there's humour in it, because, you know, Nelson really doesn't have a lot of time for any sort of mysticism. Although in other ways, you know, they're different. Ruth is an atheist, and Nelson's a lapsed Catholic. And along the way, they've got to know a druid called Cathbad. And I just think I really enjoy writing about the sort of the relationship they all have now.
And balancing the plot with the personal story. How do you do that? Do you think, you know, it's going to be a quarter personal, three quarter, or is it not as...
No, it's more sort of organic than that. It's how it works out. In this one, I think there's quite a complicated plot. So there's quite a lot of plot. But equally, this book has some very sort of important personal stuff. And you do find out, for those of you who've anyone listening who's read the other books, you do find out the answer to a question that you've been wanting to know the answer to for a while. So you find that out quite early on. But actually this one was one of the books where it seemed to come quite easily. You know, I had quite a lot of plot to do, but also I think that the personal stuff sort of fitted in with the plot quite well. So for me, it's quite a, you know, it seemed to quite a good mix in this book.
And it's set in North Norfolk.
Yeah.
Why there?
Well, really, because I first got the idea for the books in North Norfolk. Andy and I were walking with our kids along Titchwell Marsh, and Andy had happened to say that prehistoric people had thought that marshland was sacred because it's neither land nor sea, but something in between. They saw it as a kind of link to the afterlife. Neither land nor sea, neither life nor death. It was, if you like, it was a liminal zone, an in-between place. And that's why they buried bodies there, you know, the so-called bog bodies. And that really gave me the whole idea for the first book, The Crossing Places, just in that second, really. So North Norfolk, where they found, that, you know, the famous henge, seemed the perfect place. But also, you know, it is a place that's full of archaeology, absolutely full. You know, it's been inhabited for such a long time. At Haysborough, they found the oldest human footprints outside Africa. You know, it's only 9,000 years ago. I know I've been married too long to an archaeologist. Only 9,000 years ago, it was still attached to Scandinavia. You know, there's that shallow sea, so-called Doggerland. There's so much there. So I thought if I set them in North Norfolk or Norfolk, I'd never run out of archaeology.
Oh, well, thank you, Ellie. Well, we'll come back to you and chat a little bit more in just a moment. But let's move from North Norfolk to a very different landscape with Tim Moore. Tim is a travel writer and humorist. His work has appeared in The Daily Telegraph, The Observer, The Sunday Times and Esquire. Another Fine Mess is his 11th travelogue and chronicles his journey in a Ford Model T coast to coast across the US through Trump voting states and counties, meeting the men and women who put the Donald in the White House. The Daily Express said it was hilarious and scary, and the Daily Mail described it as alarmingly full of incident, very funny, even mildly transformative. I met Tim when he came to talk at Heffer's Bookshop, and I asked him why he chose to make that journey now.
It was Donald Trump. I woke up in the morning having not expected Donald Trump to win, like most people, and then he did. And it was, I thought I knew America quite well. Maybe I didn't know it at all. And when looking at all the election maps that came out in the papers the next few days, the coasts are these little big strips of Democrat blue, and there's this huge sea of red in the middle. And I realised, even though I've been to America quite a lot, I've never been to these, what they call the flyover states, because even Americans don't go to them. They just tend to, well, you know, the coastal Americans just fly over them and look out the window curiously at these strange people down there. What could these nice, kindly-minded farmers have thought was wrong with the world that they had to do this really quite extraordinary thing? My books can never be straightforward and easy, because the sad reality is that having a nice, happy, relaxing time is not terribly interesting to read about. So I always have to find a way of making things a little bit difficult for myself, but at least on this occasion, it was what didn't seem to me a contrived novelty. So I look back, because lots of people say when Trump came along, that was like, this is the end of the American dream. And also the people talk about the American century has come to an end. And I thought, well, when do these things begin? When was the when did the American dream get going? When was the American century started? And then, read about it a bit, and it seemed to be that the American economic miracle, and then all the stuff that they transformed the world with, such as cars and consumerism and all this sort of stuff, was embodied in this motor vehicle, this Model T Ford, which was the first mass-produced thing, and, you know, it put America on wheels, and then at one point half the cars in the world were Model T Ford, so it put the world on wheels. Because it was the first mass-produced car, it then was the production lines were a horrible place to be. So Henry Ford, the boss of the Ford company, realised that to stop his staff turnover being so catastrophic, he had to do something to keep his workers there. So he doubled their wages overnight. Suddenly, you know, the people who were building these cars could then afford to buy them, and that kind of, you know, kick-started the whole American way of life. So it seemed to me quite a possibly slightly contrived, but nonetheless winning, effective method of bridging these two extremes. Like, this is the start of American weapon when everything was going, had a future to look forward to, and now it seemed to me that Trump was very much America looking back to its past. I mean, he's saying make America great again, and lots of the people who voted Trump, again, just from the vox pops that I'd seen, were talking about, oh, well, you know, wanting to have a 1950s type America or something. So it was So it seemed to me that it was a good way of exploring both of those things at once.
And they're beautiful cars, but not quite so easy to drive.
No. Well, it's funny, isn't it? Because they are. They're, I mean, obviously, I became deeply fond of them, my particular car. But it looks like something's been knocked up in a shed by a couple of old blokes with hand tools. So the idea that this was, you know, mass-produced, it seemed extraordinary. And the control method, again, because these cars were being sold to people who'd never driven. Henry Ford just thought, what's the cheapest way of making a car run? There's no gear stick, but there's one of the pedals, which would normally be like the brake, is kind of the clutch, but actually it's not really a clutch, because you put it, stamp it down to the ground, that's low gear, take it off, that's high gear, the accelerator's a stick on the steering column. All these old Model T Ford collectors that I'd, for me, quite sensibly been in touch with before I left, saying, OK, I'm going to do this thing. And they say, so have you driven a Model T Ford? No, nope. Okay, well, just don't do that, because it'll take you probably a year, maybe like 1,000 miles. I said, well, I understand that, but nonetheless, I am doing it, and I haven't got time to do any of that, so I'm just going to get a car and go. They just said, well, good luck with that.
That community came to your rescue time and time again, didn't they? And that's a really heartwarming part of the book.
Yeah, they were wonderful. You know, they were like my kind of idealised grandparents. I mean, they were fundamentally, it was useful, I suppose, from the demographic selection of people who can fix Model T Fords and people who voted Trump. It's quite a large crossover there. So they were old guys who, you know, often were retired, which is why they had the time. But they were so welcoming and friendly and helpful and practical. I realised quite early on watching the TV news that things had become so polarised from a political viewpoint. I didn't really want to get into conversations that would very quickly become really very heated arguments with no possibility of any resolution at all. So yes, my car was really very badly broken and I might be staying with them for a week. I just sort of skirted around the issue.
Well, what emerged was that you seemed quite often like these people who had voted Trump, which surprised you.
Well, it surprised me that I should have really thought, well, of course, they're just nice old guys living out in the countryside. And they were the salt of the earth. They were really friendly, helpful people. And then you'd get talking after a couple of days in their company, and they would just idly say things like, well, of course, you know, I've got to kind of keep some dried food here because, you know, when it all comes down, when there's the, you know, the day of reckoning, they thought the world might end because there'd be a sort of zombie apocalypse or sunspots or something, but quite often it was just a straight-up judgment day scenario. And that's why so few of them say, oh, global warming, well, what does it matter? I mean, the planet's going to be rebooted when you know, the Lord comes again to... I thought, wow, this is quite kind of medieval things to hear from these. And then they were... I think there's a large strand in rural Americans that is... goes back to my idea of, like, you know, the kind of the snake oil salesman or like someone who turns up, and they'd like people who turn up and tell improbable stories and just seem a bit wacky and way out there. They kind of have a bit of showmanship. So I think they like Trump because he wasn't a politician, because he's a conspiracy theorist as well. I mean, he has all sorts of, like, the whole thing with Obama's background and stuff, and they would sign up for all sorts of things that you would never expect these really placid, quite boring looking old guys to say. That they would, you know, they say, oh, well, you know, the thing is, Tim, you probably didn't hear this back in the UK, but I heard Barack Obama say with my own ears, he said, if there was a war between America and Iran, he would be on the side of Iran, and he said he was proud to fund Muslim terrorism. And I'm thinking, like, no, he really, really didn't say those things. I never really quite managed to square those two things, that they would just be so down to earth and friendly and then say these really, really barking mad out there things.
And where were they getting those things from? Had they genuinely thought they'd seen them? Had they seen them? Somebody told them about them?
I think a lot of it was just, as we now know, fake news things being seeded on Facebook. But I think, you know, basically it's just a human nature. If someone says something that you want to believe, then you'll believe it. What scared me was the fact that so many of them wanted to believe it in the first place. I couldn't really see why they felt things had gone so far down the road to hell in a handcart that they had to think the world was coming to an end and they had to elect Donald Trump to be their president because that was the only answer. I suppose the one constant which people did sometimes talk about, which I could see with my own eyes, you know, the definition of prosperity or of confidence is that you expect to do better than your parents did. You know, hundreds of years, that's been the case in America, particularly since the dawn of the Model T era. Things have got better and better and better and better. And, you know, you'd expect to have a nicer house than your parents did and a bigger car and just more money. And just because the most recent generation has not done as well as their parents, well, I can see it must be a bit of a kick in the teeth looking at your dad driving around a nicer car than you and stuff. But rather than just saying, oh, well, that's a bit of a blow, they've said, OK, well, actually, the world's coming to an end. And I have to go and do something really radical to, I don't know, accelerate that? I've got no idea, but it was... I couldn't really see that was sufficient excuse
And what about the practical side of it, the writing of it? Were you making notes all the way through? Were you writing it as you went along? How do you write? Because you're a travel writer, so what is your form of writing when you're travelling?
I'm quite old now, so when I was a younger, more vigorous man, I used to... and also technology was in its infancy. I used to have a little notebook and I would think of something pertinent to note, and I would stop by the side of the road on my bicycle or my donkey or whatever else I was travelling across the country and write things down. Even when you're just scribbling things down, you're sort of getting things into something. You're vaguely editing your thoughts into something which is going to be slightly more page-ready. I seem to have put myself in situations now where that's not an option. So when I'm driving a Model T Ford, I need at least four hands, frankly. Anyway, so I had my phone, which was sort of bolted to the dashboard in a completely inauthentic but nonetheless necessary means of navigation and of telling me how fast I was going, because there was only one gauge on this Model T Ford, which tells you whether the battery was charging or not, which is utterly useless. Thanks for that, Henry Ford. So I had a voice recording function on this thing, so I'd occasionally get a wobbly finger and press record and then just yak into it for a bit about what was happening or something I'd thought about or something I'd just seen. That has the benefit of total immediacy, and you come back and think, okay, nothing has gone unrecorded. Everything that happened that I experienced, that I thought about, that I saw, that I heard, everyone I met, because I would surreptitiously, sorry middle Americans, I did surreptitiously recall quite a lot of conversations with blokes in cafes and that sort of thing. But then you come home thinking, okay, great, and then you think, oh no, now I've got to listen to them all and spend months actually transcribing it all. Frankly, when you're having a bad time, there's a little voice that's saying, okay, this is terrible, but it's going to make great copy. When everything's going wrong and the car's like bursting into flames and driving off the side of a cliff, that's like, this is the good stuff. But that does mean that my vocal delivery is lacking somewhat, I can say. So I can't... What am I saying? Other than this high-pitched yelp, I can't hear that. I'm going to listen to it again and again and again and again.
Did it change you? I mean, one final question. Do you feel different at the end of that journey than you did at the beginning?
I might never fully understand why these, salt of the earth, placid middle Americans of a certain age voted for Trump, but I can sympathise with it, because having spent so much time with them, all of them, without exception, they were self-made men in a way that they thought Donald Trump was, although, frankly, you could dispute that, in the way that Henry Ford definitely was. They were farmers' sons, and they'd started out, and they had a good idea for a business, or just sheer hard work, like God took an existing business and made it into, and most of them were quite wealthy in retirement. If you had achieved that in your life, and somehow you had the idea that... people were not, working 13 hours a day, because they aren't. Fundamentally, life has got easier for most people, so they don't have to go and do that. But I can see why you might feel a bit bitter if you made it all for yourself. That this is why I suppose all the things about, oh well, everyone's on these handouts and benefits, that really kind of gained traction. But it must be difficult for them, having spent so long looking into the glorious future, now realizing their best days are behind them. So, yeah, I came back with a much better sympathy for people who had done this, on the face of a very unsympathetic act of electing this orange lunatic man-child into the office of the most powerful man on earth.
And Another Fine Mess by Tim Moore is published by Yellow Jersey Press. Listening to that with me was our studio guest on Bookmark today, crime writer Ellie Griffiths, here to talk about her latest novel, The Stone Circle. Ellie, you were saying earlier that you did a tour of America. When was that?
Well, that was last year, last September.
What were your impressions? Because it's a very tumultuous period in politics.
It's a very tumultuous period, and it's very interesting. I found that such an interesting interview with Tim there. And I think we sort of have to understand why people did vote for Trump, don't we? As he obviously did, start to try and understand some of it. I got the impression that people were quite angry and quite upset, some of the people I met. But one of the wonderfully stirring things I did find was that as you sort of travelled through the Florida states, I met a lot of women who were standing for office. And there was a wonderful bookshop owner in Mount Dora who was standing. And I did follow that up after the last election, and she did get in. And if women like Chrissy are in, I feel that's a real positive. I did actually leave with quite a lot of, confidence and optimism. But I have to say, everyone that I meet in America, they seem lovely, and they might well have voted for Trump. But, people are very kind and very nice to you. So You know, it's an interesting thing, isn't it?
Well, let's go back to the Guardian quote that I get read earlier on. It says, Griffiths supplies proof that thrillers can increase the pulse rate while tackling more serious issues, which is very true of your book. It's that then they are plots, so they're obviously crime plots, but you do bring in other issues. It's important to you, obviously.
Yes, it is. I mean, obviously, the books are set in real time. Funnily enough, this one, The Stone Circle, set in early 2016. So it's pre-Trump and pre-Brexit. I'm quite tempted to leave Ruth there. And I couldn't resist one little thing where she's listening to the radio and she says, oh, she looks forward to telling Kate, her daughter, later in the year that Hillary Clinton's been elected. I couldn't just resist that little bit of a hindsight. But it's important for me to have real issues in the books. The Chalk Pit, which was book 9, was about rough sleepers in The Dark Angel. That it's in Italy and that there's a sort of immigration issue there. So yes, it is important for me to have, you know, real life issues in there. I think for me that's one of the strengths of the crime writing genre, really, because it is a genre where you really can look, I mean, this sounds a bit heavy and boring, but you can sort of look at society, and there are not many genres you can do that, because if a crime happens, it genuinely does sort of cut across all layers of society, and you can genuinely bring in sort of different sorts of people. I've had my share of slightly eccentric aristocrats in the book, but I've had also people on the margins of society, and that very much is what would happen, you know, when a crime is committed. So for me, that is one of the great strengths of the crime genre. And it's quite often, isn't it, about class and about, you know, social issues, really.
And where do you start then? Does the issue that you're going to write about, as well as the plot, does that kind of naturally arise? Or do you think, I'm going to write and centre this around child abuse?
Well, really, it's the place for me, particularly with the Ruth books. The place is always the first thing. So I was saying about, you know, the decision to set the first book on the North Norfolk coast, what was that whole idea about marshland being sort of an in-between place between life and death. And every book has come from a place. So this actually came from rereading that first book when I was touring Denmark, actually, where they just published The Crossing Places, and realising there was a bit of unfinished business there. So it always starts with the place, and then really the crime and the police side comes a bit later.
And you mentioned Cathbad earlier. There is a whole community in this book around Ruth and around Harry. And at the back, you have like little questionnaires for the characters that that they answer. So that these are very real to you, but it gives them a sense of life. We see different aspects of characters when they're relating to different people.
It's one of the great joys of writing a crime series, really, because, again, I don't think there's another genre, except possibly fantasy, I suppose, or sagas, where you get to write a whole series. You know, my first four books were written under my own name, women's fiction. And when I left those characters, I left them forever, you know. So it feels wonderful to write a crime series and to just keep, you know, to keep coming back to those characters. And I've been with Ruth now for 10 years. I've seen her daughter grow up. I've seen the relationships. You know, Cathbad in the first book was really just a suspect. And now he's sort of an integral part of the series. And the other police sergeants, Judy and Clough, now have their own lives and their own complications. So for me, that has really been a privilege to get to write so many books about these characters.
How did you choose your writing name, just as a side question?
Well, as you know, Lee, my real name is Domenica De Rosa, which sounds completely made up. You know, it's Italian. My dad was Italian, and it means Sunday of the Rose. My first four books were kind of, I suppose you might call them, women's fiction, and it sort of went quite well with that because they're about Italy and families and relationships. But then when I wrote The Crossing Places, my agent told me I needed a crime name. And my grandmother had been called Ellen Griffiths. And so I chose that name. My grandma died when I was quite young. I didn't know her very well, but she was from Norfolk. And one of the things I'd always been told about her was that she was a very clever woman and she loved reading. She loved books. But she'd had to leave school at 13 to go into service. So I thought she'd really like to have a book under her name. So I wanted to be Ellen Griffiths. At some point, the publishers decided that I would be Ellie. And I thought to ask them about a year ago, why? You know, why did I become Ellie? And my editor said, oh, it looked a bit tidier, really. So there you are. I became Ellie because it looked tidier on the covers.
And you feel like an Ellie because obviously when you go out and meet writers, they address you as Ellie. I'm addressing you as Ellie. Do you feel an Ellie?
Now I do. One of my nieces is Ellie, which is slightly you know, a little bit confusing. But of course, my niece is young and beautiful. So maybe I feel a bit younger when I'm being Ellie. I often think that I feel a bit taller when I'm being Ellie.
Tall Ellie. Okay, well, let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is These Foolish Things by Brian Ferry. Why this one?
Well, I love this song because it's a story, isn't it? And there's some wonderful words to it. And I just think Brian Ferry's voice puts an extra little ironical spin on it.
Oh, will you never set me free? The ties that bound us are still around us. There's no escape that I can see.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And we're talking to Ellie Griffiths on Bookmark today about her latest crime novel, The Stone Circle. It's the 11th book.
Yes,
series,
it is.
Ellie. Well-established characters now. You must feel quite comfortable writing them.
Yes, it's really nice to get back to them. I write another series too, which is set in the 50s, Stevens and Mephisto. And last year I did a standalone, which is called The Stranger Diaries. So in a way, it's not like I'm writing one Ruth book after another. But when I'm writing something else, I always want to get back to her. I'm always glad, you know, to get back to Ruth and North Norfolk and Nelson and the team, really.
And has it gone where you thought it would go?
No, not really, no. I mean, I really, when I wrote the first book, didn't think there would be a series and you know, maybe thought if I was lucky, there'd be two or three. So it has done strange things. And I hate saying this because it's a bit sort of, I don't know, pretentious. But the characters have done things that have surprised me and have gone in directions I hadn't expected. But in a way, that's like life, isn't it? You know, things happen in life that you don't expect. And I suppose the good thing about writing a series is, you know, if you're writing a one-off book, something happens, for example, there might be a pregnancy, and then you can leave it there, can't you? But if you're writing a series, you know, that baby has got to get born, and there are repercussions, and the repercussions keep on happening. And I suppose that's it's a challenge, but also one of the really satisfying things.
And do you know how long it will last? How long you will keep writing, Ruth?
I don't really. I mean, I won't go on forever, but I had always thought there would be 10, so kind of a bit of a surprise to have book 11, really. But there will be at least a couple more. There will be, I've started number 12, so there'll be a number 12. And, you know, I don't know, I thought you can't end on 11, can you? It's an odd number to end on. So there'll be at least 12, and there'll be at least a couple more. That's Excellent. All I'm saying now.
Excellent news. Thank you, Ellie. We'll come back to you in just a moment. But let's take a little sidestep now and hear from Carol Carman. She's a former presenter and producer on BBC Radio Cambridgeshire. She writes poetry and short stories for the Reaper website. Gingerbread Children is her first novel. Set in a school for witches, it blends fantasy, murder, mystery and gingerbread. The book is dedicated to Terry Pratchett, and when I met Carol, I asked her why.
Terry Pratchett really opened my eyes. The first book of his that I bought was called Mort, and it was just so funny. It was one of the funniest books I've ever read. I've always been attracted to books that make me laugh, make me smile and make me think. And Mort just ticked all those boxes because here was this other world. And the one thing I remember from Mort was Terry Pratchett said that this skinny lad seemed to be composed entirely of knees. And it was just such a wonderful picture. You can just picture it in your mind, can't you? This gangly lad who's all elbows and knees and joints and completely uncoordinated. And I hadn't realised that books could be written that way. Because when you're at school, you get schooled in the classics and you get schooled in a sort of certain way. But along came Terry Pratchett and just sort of opened the doors in my mind and went, look, see what you can do. This is marvellous. And I've always written, and I thought, I wonder if I can do something like that.
So how did you come to write the book? What was your starting point?
I'd been travelling on the A14 and I... Oh, no.
It's you an exotic place.
Yes, you wouldn't think this would have anything to do with magic. I'd been travelling on the A14 and I'd been annoyed by a guy on a motorbike. And then we hit the traffic jam and, of course, this motorbiker just sort of wove his way past me and up the middle of this. In my head, I was just chewing over the fact that he'd annoyed me. And I thought, you know, I would just love to be able to get hold of him, tell him what I thought of him, and pitch him and his motorbike into a field and just leave him thinking about what I'd said. But obviously, that's never going to happen. And then I thought, well, I could turn this into a story because I've always written. And I came home and I wrote a short story. And it was all about this woman who was driving along, been annoyed by this biker, and she doesn't actually stop in a traffic jam. What she does is she slews her car round and causes an accident, and there's all this knock-on accident as one car and van careers into another, into another, into another, and it's like a massive back-end shunt. And she does what I wanted to do. She grabs hold of this biker, she throws him, she tells him everything she wants to tell him, throws him into a field, throws his motorbike into a field. And I thought, well, that's no good. You can't leave everybody wounded and bleeding in an accident, can you? So I thought, what if she could then unwind that accident so that everybody else, except this biker, goes on their way, none the wiser, everybody's happy. And that's where the element of magic came in. And so that's what I wrote. She unwinds this accident and everybody goes on their way. And then I thought, why would she do that? Perhaps it's some sort of test. Perhaps she's a witch in training. And further back in the queue of traffic, there are a couple of observers who are watching her performance. And I thought, that's a really good basis for some sort of story and some sort of other world, a witch's training thing. I took the essence of the idea that witches are trained and observed. They're not just, they don't spring fully formed into the world. They have to be trained in the arts and they have to be observed and they have to pass tests and exams like you do at a normal university. And so, in effect, I took the essence of that story and then created this world out of it.
Where do you start when you're building a world?
It's got to be somewhere where there is room for magic. I couldn't set it in too modern a world because I don't necessarily think it would have worked. Because you've got to, whenever you read anything, you suspend your disbelief. And the less modern clutter there is, for me anyway, the better it is. Because if you need somebody who has a hard time washing their clothes, let's say, you don't want them to be able to just push it in a washing machine. If your character needs to have some hardship washing their clothes, then it's got to be set in a world where that is not possible other than by getting in a washing tub and physically manual labour doing it that way. That was, in effect, sort of the basis for it. It had to be a world that had room for magic in it. But it's got to be a world that's peopled with real people, with real emotions and, you know, real dilemmas and real problems.
So it's called Gingerbread Children. It's got magic in it, yes. As you say, real problems. Based on fairy tale, we think of Gingerbread Children and the Hansel and Gretel story. There's a lot of room for manoeuvre, isn't there? A lot of inspiration in fairy tales, of spells and curses and magic and evil.
And also, if you think about it, any story is always written from one side. They say that history is written by the victors. Fairy stories and any story is written by someone who wants to present a particular point of view. Now, the thing about fairy tales is that if you delve deep into the history of them, there's always some moral there, or it's to explain something to children to, in effect, prepare them for later in life. But it's always written from a certain point of view. So what happens if you flip that point of view? If you take some of the characters and turn them round and say, yeah, but maybe the witch in Hansel and Gretel wasn't such a bad witch after all. Maybe something happened that made her do what she did. And once you look at something like that and pick it up and turn it round and see it from the other side, it just opens up a whole world of possibilities.
Yeah, and it's witches and matriarchs, very female-centred, the book.
In effect, I suppose, being a woman, it's easier for me to write about women than necessarily to write about men. Having said that, within Gingerbread Children, there are male characters. The most prevalent male character is the cat, or the familiar, I should say, the familiar. Every witch, you know, has her familiar. And the familiars in this book are all male. So you do get the back and forth between male and female. So it's not entirely a woman's book or a girl's book. I've had reports from guys who have read it and said that they really enjoyed it as well. And obviously, you know, having the strong female characters didn't seem to bother them. They just enjoyed the book for what it is.
Who is the book aimed at? What's your... Because it looks almost like a YA novel, and the content sort of seems YA-ish, and yet it's also, you're using words and concepts that are quite adult.
It's aimed at adults of any age. I think when you get to 14, perhaps, then you're in that sort of looking to read more adult content and more adult books. So I'd say it was suitable for anybody who's over 14, but it's definitely not a little kiddie's book. It might look all nice and sweet and sugary, but if you have a good look at the cover, there's jagged trees on it, and there's a hint of menace, and there is mystery, and there is darkness in it.
And what next for you after this?
I do have another one, another novel that's already written. It needs knocking into shape, I must admit. So with a bit of luck and a following wind, I should be bringing that out next year. It's set in the same town. It's a town called Maund. And it does have a connection to the University of Nature in that there is a witch in it who has been trained at the University of Nature. But apart from that, it is a completely different book altogether.
And Gingerbread Children by Carol Carmen is published by McCall Press. We've been talking to Ellie Griffiths today on Bookmark about her novel, a crime novel, The Stone Circle, which is published by Quirkers. We're coming to the end of our time with you, unfortunately, Ellie, but I do want to pick up on something that Carol was talking about there, about menace and darkness. How dark can you go in crime novels? Or how dark do you want to go, I suppose?
I thought Carol's novel sounded great, actually. You know, definitely right up my street. Well, you know, it is up to you. And we were saying earlier on, it is, there's a big range in crime fiction. You do get what the Americans call sort of cosy fiction at one end. And on the other end, you get stuff that looks into the real darkest side of, you know, human nature. And crime writers are quite well known for prophesying dark things that happen. I know Val McDermott wrote a book about a character who basically was Jimmy Savile sort of years and years ago. Mick Herron seems to have, you know, anticipated loads of things in his wonderful Slough House books. I suppose for me, sometimes my books, particularly in the States, actually, are marketed as being kind of cosy because I suppose they've got a returning character and they're set in a sort of beautiful part of the world. But they are also quite dark. And I think that's quite important to me because murder is dark, even if it happened thousands of years ago. You know, it is quite dark. And I think I don't want them to be absolutely terrifying. But a sense of menace is OK, I think.
And they're very visual. Have you had any interest from TV companies?
Oh, well, thank you. I often think, because my mum was an artist and one of my sisters is an artist, and I can't draw, apart from I can draw horses jumping sideways for some reason. But, you know, maybe this is what I do instead of...
It's a niche market.
Yeah, it is a niche market. I'm happy to draw one for you later. There is some interest from TV. I mean, this has happened before and it seems to be quite a slow process, but there is a TV company who has the option on them and they've written a script. So that's where we are at the moment. And it's a great script. I didn't write it. A writer called Jess Williams wrote it. But it seems very good. She seems to have really understood Nelson and Ruth and the setting, you know, and the archaeology. So we'll just see what happens. That's where it is at the moment.
Fingers crossed. When you're writing it, do you have anybody in your head when you think about Ruth and Harry?
I've always thought that Ruth Jones would be a good Ruth. She just has the right sort of face, very similar to the way that I imagine Ruth. And Ruth Jones is such an intelligent actress. I think she could play that side of Ruth very, very well. Perhaps more controversially, when I think of Nelson, I kind of think of a young Ted Hughes. And there's a picture in my head. It's Ted Hughes in sort of waders in some frozen stream, probably slaughtering some wildlife. But the actor who looks very like him is Richard Armitage. So for me, Richard Armitage would be my perfect Nelson.
Well, he was very rakish when he was young, Ted Hughes, wasn't he?
Yes, very rakish and dangerous looking, I guess. I mean, I think, you know, Nelson is possibly a slightly less dangerous person to be in a relationship with, but, you know, has that dangerous, hard look.
And my next question is always what's next for you, but you mentioned earlier, are you carrying on with the series?
Yes, I've got a couple of things before that, though. So I've just finished writing the fifth Stevens and Mephisto book, which I had called Now You See Her, but I think it might have a different title. And I'm bringing out a children's book in May, which is Crime for Children, sort of a younger age group than Carol's book, sort of 8 to 11. It's called A Girl Called Justice. And it's a crime novel set in a girls' boarding school in the 30s.
Wow. And
then after that will be Ruth number 12.
Ruth number 12. And the question we ask all our guests on Bookmark, what are you reading at the moment?
Well, you know, one of the great privileges of being a writer is you sometimes get sent advance copies. So I'm reading an advance copy of William Shaw's new book, which is called Deadland. And William Shaw is a really good crime writer. He wrote a trilogy. Actually, there are four books in it, so not a trilogy, set in the 60s. But this, Deadland, is the second in a series set in present day. And it's based in Dungeness. And that's such a wonderful sort of wasteland, really, of a setting. And William writes marvellous female characters as well, so it's a real winner, this one. I think it's out in April.
Thank you, Ellie. We'll come back to you in a moment for your last choice of music, but just a heads up on our next show. Studio guest on the next show is Michelle Diskin-Bates. She's talking about her memoir, Stand Against Injustice, her fight to prove her brother Barry George innocent of the murder of Jill Dando. We'll also hear from children's author Andy Shepherd. Her debut novel, The Boy Who Grew Dragons, has been shortlisted for the Waterstones Book Prize. And Peter Murphy will be talking about his latest courtroom thriller, One Law for the Rest of Us. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Ellie, which is Thunder Road by Bruce Springsteen. Why this one?
Well, like Ruth, the heroine of my novels, I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. I really, it's no exaggeration to say I love him. You know, I think he's a wonderful lyricist, a wonderful musician, wonderful person. And the times I've seen him live have been some of the happiest times in my life.
Screen door slams, Mary's dress waves. Like a vision, she dances across the porch as the radio plays. Roy Orbison singing for the lonely. Hey, that's me, and I want you only. Don't turn me home again, I just can't face myself alone again. Don't run back inside, darling. What I'm here for.